providers that would be covered. So input on that would be incredibly helpful. You didn't get into the labor things. Why?
Well, I wanted to try and keep it short, Senator, and but I am concerned about the proposal from the AFL-CIO to establish a rate-setting type program for hospitals. And some of the facts that I cited in that are based on the Maryland example, and that has proven to be very costly there.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I mean, clearly the states you list here are states that have high Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates to start with, as opposed to ours being low, and yet these states have found it unworkable. I'm just wondering how it would work for such a low reimbursement state. I mean, we can't artificially increase the match, but we would indeed, wouldn't we be asking for a higher portion of general fund to make up the difference?
I agree. I think that's clearly the problem you'd face.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Of your five hospitals, I believe the one in Corvallis does have a union contract. Is that right?
Four of the five do.
Oh, four of the five.
Correct.
Okay. I'm interested in the community college nursing program because I've talked to the president of Lane Community College and other places, and I'm getting the answer that we can't afford the, we don't have staff people to teach the classes, we can't afford the equipment for the labs and the room for the labs and so on and so forth, but your community colleges?
Well, we're definitely in active partnership with the community college. We will provide the, quote, lab space here. We look to do that here.
Okay.
Certainly the clinical experience activity would be here as well as at North Lincoln Hospital in Lincoln City. They are expensive programs, no doubt about it.
Well, there are family wage jobs out there for people who qualify, and we simply do not have training programs for enough nurses. That's a nationwide problem, but it certainly is a problem in Oregon, and I think we need to do something about it. I really appreciate the fact that you are doing something. Now, I am going to take a moment to stand at ease until we bring in more chairs up in front, because we have a lot of people who are standing, and then we'll get back to the hearing.
Thank you.
And the written testimony is very helpful because I've made notes of some of the things that you're talking about, and we are concerned about the extending the tax credit to practitioners and not just the doctors but to other practitioners.
That would be a great help, I believe.
Yeah, and I think that's very important that we do that. Okay, John, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself and we'll kind of get started here?
Yes, my name is John Zier. Senators, thank you for coming to Newport and giving us this opportunity to provide some testimony regarding rural health care.
Okay.
I am the clinic director and family nurse practitioner at the Yahats Community Health Clinic in beautiful sunny Yahats, Oregon.
Good.
Rural clinics, rural hospitals, and rural emergency systems need your support. Why? Because together they form the rural health safety net. Support is needed because in the rural setting, patient populations are low, but the expenses of providing care are very similar to that found in urban settings. This creates a constant flow of red ink that threatens the viability of rural health systems. And yet, it is still more cost-effective to treat people locally with prevention-focused services than it is to send them to the city. Numerous studies have demonstrated that local access and primary care prevention-focused services save money in the long run. What does it mean to refer to a clinic or a healthcare system as a safety net? It means that people who don't own a car or can't drive are able to walk to the clinic. It means people without insurance or income utilize the clinic for their dental needs. So the clinic writes a grant and gets the Northwest Dental Van to provide free dental services, but the clinic receives no reimbursement for doing that. It means the clinic helps patients obtain thousands of dollars worth of free medication from pharmaceutical company programs for low-income patients. Again, the clinic receives no reimbursement for doing that. A safety net clinic is where people without means go for help with their debilitating depression. So we write another grant and obtain free counseling for those patients. The clinic gets no reimbursement for doing that. A safety net clinic in a rural setting means taking care of wealthy families who live on the hill and people who live under the bridge. It means raising local contributions to make a sliding fee program possible. It means not being directly reimbursed for many of our programs and services. It means having no bargaining power when establishing rates with HMOs and insurance companies. It means losing $3 every time I see a Medicare patient in my clinic. It means trying to find alternatives for people no longer covered by the Oregon Health Plan. In the Yahats zip code area in the last year, 30 patients lost Oregon Health Plan coverage. That may not seem like a large number, but remember, Yahats population is 600, and most of those residents are retirees who are covered by Medicare, so 30 is in fact a very large number. Clinics and their providers can't and won't work in a vacuum. There has to be a hospital nearby to provide the next level of care, and there has to be an emergency service to bridge the distance between clinics, communities, and the hospitals. You can support the Rural Health Safety Net with the following actions, some of which have already been mentioned. Continue the current tax credit for rural health care providers. It has great value for recruitment and retention. Develop a new tax credit for rural EMTs, many of whom are volunteers. Develop rural health care education for EMTs, medical assistants, and professional nurses. I've heard you mention the shortage. It's real. And one of the other things I would add to that is that providing care in a rural environment is not the same as providing care in an urban environment. You need to train people in a rural environment. I am currently sponsoring an OHSU nurse practitioner student in my clinic because that's the only way she can get experience in a local rural environment, which is where she wants to work. And healthcare is certainly different there, and she can't learn that in Portland. Maintain the current cost-based reimbursement for rural hospitals providing care to Oregon Health Plan patients. That's the minimum, and without that, it's going to be very difficult. Make group malpractice insurance available to rural nurse practitioners and physician assistants, just as you have to physicians. The cost in my clinic alone, which is a small clinic that sees a little over 2,000 patients a year, is $10,000 a year for malpractice insurance. We do no OB care. You can imagine what it would be like if we opened it up to OB patients. Make group health insurance available to employees of rural clinics by developing a system for all of the clinics to be treated as one single unit. When you have four employees eligible for benefits, it's very difficult to get a competitive rate, and you end up with healthcare professionals whose own health insurance is significantly less than that of the Oregon Health Plan patients they take care of. Fund the Office of Rural Health at the Oregon OHSU. Their assistance to rural health systems is invaluable. Specifically, provide the Office of Rural Health with the means to provide financial assistance to fragile rural health clinics who are on the edge. Work with the Oregon Health Plan administrators to ensure that rural clinics are reimbursed in a timely manner. Many clinics received recently a letter from OMAP apologizing for how far they are behind. I understand their problems, but it makes it difficult for me to make payroll. Finally, although you can't do this directly, please work with national figures on changing the reimbursement schedule for Medicare patients so that rural health clinics can truly be paid at cost rather than losing $30 every time we see one of our elderly patients. Thank you.
Thank you. John, on several of those, the last one that you listed I think is important, being paid on time. I talked to the new director of OMAP, Barney Spade, of the Oregon Health Plan, and I told him, I said, Barney, I have a bill that would require that you pay people reimbursement sooner than 7 months, which some of it is. But I said, I don't think that's a legislative matter. I think that is an in-house matter, and I would hope that you would do something about it. But, you know, it's always helpful to have a bill sitting in the background, I guess, that lets them know that we're interested. But that's an issue, and we've heard that a lot, that my own health care clinic in Springfield, the one that is a federally funded health care clinic, and that was their main complaint, that it takes sometimes up to 7 months before they get the full reimbursement, which is ridiculous.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you for coming. And just follow up on that. Right now, if you do electronic billing, you can be paid within 3 or 4 days. It's those, and the reason OMAP is so far behind is because almost half of the providers do not have the ability at this point in time to bill electronically. So basically, I have a bill in that will actually work on incentives, maybe helping providers be able to get set up to have electronic billing. That is an issue, and we are addressing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you federally qualified?
No, we're a rural health clinic,
right.
But not a FQHC.
Okay.
A follow-up?
Yes.
What would it take to get you there?
To be an FQHC? We don't meet the criteria for that. That requires multiple providers, multiple locations, the capacity for transportation, right. Psychiatric services. That's not something in a community of Yahats that we would have the resources for. We could participate in one, but we would not be the appropriate people to be one.
Thank you.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, the reason I bring that up is, I think we need to aggressively be looking at ways to get non-federally qualified, even if it's combined administration or whatever we have to do it, because there's a lot of money available, and the president has made that a priority of his, and with so many clinics that are just scraping along, if there are federal dollars and we can find ways to get there, I think it's something we need to aggressively be pursuing.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Karen Whitaker and Scott Ekblack, would you please come up and address some of the concerns? We have Karen Whitaker and Scott Ekblack, who are with the Office of Rural Health, which you mentioned, and OHSU, which you mentioned. And so we have experts in the audience who can help us.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would like John Zaire to give a copy of our...
Yes, John, we need a copy of that.
Your testimony?
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Thank you very much, Senator Miles Anderson. Yeah, it is important if you are testifying that you have copies, but if you only have one copy, we need it.
Because we can make copies.
Well, no, but, that was a very detailed report, and there were many good, very good suggestions, and so it will be helpful to have that. Would you mind introducing yourself, please?
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the OHSU Center for Rural Health, which includes the Office of Rural Health, the State Office of Rural Health.
And for the record, I'm Scott Ekblad, and I'm the deputy director of the State Office of Rural Health.
Could you do you have a response to the concerns of?
Well, I Senator, members of the committee, I could talk for a long time about this, but I know that you have time constraints.
Well,
but I think if we can pick up some of these points, the issue on the federally qualified health center is an important one. The clinic in Yahats is too small to qualify for that program, and until recently, the agency that governs this program would not allow clinics to band together and form a series of networks. However, they are interested in entertaining that type of proposal. So I think that it would be a potential that they should perhaps look at. The governance of a federally qualified health center is very different. It requires a private nonprofit and a governing board, and is not the same thing as having a practice. So that would be something that they would have to think hard about, whether or not they wanted to pursue that type of governance, and the community would really have to be in support of that type of move. But it certainly is a way to capture some federal funds to cover uninsured patients, and is a good idea.
Can that correspond? Just briefly, Mr. Chair, and I saw you there, which is why part of the reason I brought it up, because I knew the chair was going to call you up, and knowing that the feds are at least entertaining the concept of a different way of doing business, and knowing we have to have something overarching to make this happen, and with the realization that not too long ago we created the Rural Health Association, I think we have a lot of pieces potentially in place to move forward with this. But I think it would behoove us to be very aggressive in this exploration in the next few months, because we will have to do something legislatively to bring this about. So, and I also see Ed Patterson there, so it's another reason I brought it up. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Scott, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, I could comment on the issue of the tax credit, which has been brought up a couple different times, and I can say that we have conducted a survey once or twice in the 13 years I've been in the office, and it's been very clear that the tax credit is very helpful, particularly in retaining providers in rural areas, and it's also very helpful in recruiting them as well. So maintaining, if not expanding, would be very important.
Good.
So since you brought that up, and we are proposing doubling the tax credit, do you think you could provide us with some extrapolate impacts on a move like that? It would be helpful when we bring the bill forward. I know it's guessing, but, you know.
I have Ed up here in just a minute also.
Right.
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, we have been working with the Oregon Medical Association to get data on income so that we can look at income differential. We did a survey of our rural practitioners at the beginning of the 2001 session, so that was a while back. But at the time, we found a $20,000 to $30,000 income differential between rural and urban practice. So the $5,000, which is taxable the following year, by the way, doesn't go very far toward making up that difference. So certainly, doubling the tax credit would be a very worthy endeavor, and I'm sure would be welcomed by the rural practitioners.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting
Patterson,
us.
Would you please come up? We're going to address this issue before we move on because, where's John? John is still here. We want to continue to address the issue that you're raising before we move on to other things. Now, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Ed Patterson, I'm the Executive Director of the Rural Health Association. I'm here representing that group today. And you know, maybe the rest of the committee doesn't know, but I've been working closely with you and with Senator Cruz to develop a bill that would do what I think needs to be done to guarantee there is a functional, sustainable rural health safety net program. And it'll be a four-part bill. I think it's... I had some written testimony, I believe. Did you see
it? Oh, I'm sorry. They were talking about the last one. Good.
And I'll be brief, but the whole concept is to identify and put in the statutes the definition of what a rural health safety net needs to do. And I think in my experience would indicate that we have to put the actual policy decision in the statute so it can be referred to by policymakers down the road. So I have drafted a preamble for this statute and outlines three components of the healthcare safety net. One is we've got to have pre-hospital care needs to be guaranteed at some level in rural parts of the state. As you know, back in 99, the legislature adopted a proposal that would provide $1.2 million, half of which would go to the Office of Rural Health and half of which would go to the AHEC program. The Rural Health Program...
Would you explain the AHEC program?
Oh, excuse me, I used the acronym. the Area Health Education Center.
Now, tell us what they are and what they
There are four programs, and it's within OHSU, four geographically located AHECs, and they're all in the four corners of the state, so to speak. The idea would be is that they would put together a training program for rural emergency medical technicians, who for the most part are volunteers, for the most part have to pay for their own training and education. And it was beginning as to become a burden on some of them, and it's becoming more difficult for the rural areas to recruit volunteer EMTs. Well, last session in 2003, that money disappeared in some other legislative priority. The $600,000 that the Office of Rural Health got was provided for grants, $300,000 a year for grants for rural emergency medical service programs, and they provided grants to purchase radios, a couple of ambulances, et cetera, because the local communities could not support that kind of capital expenditures. And it was working great for about 4 years, and then last session the whole 1.2 went a different direction. And it's my belief that if we would establish a rural health, sustainable rural health safety net, we could use that as a priority, and you could use that, and future legislators could use that as a priority to maintain the funding and the importance of these rural health programs. Secondly, you heard John Zier talk about the need for some of the rural health clinics. There is a shortage, as you also heard David talk about, a shortage of all kinds of rural health providers. And we have to increase the number of primary care physicians, primary care providers in rural Oregon. The rural health safety nets fill a very important role in doing that. Two sessions ago, we had a $3 million bill that came out of then Representative Cruz's committee, supported by Senator Morissette, that would have appropriated $3 million for rural health safety nets. It went to Ways and Means Committee towards the end of the session and was appropriated for some other priority of some other legislators. Again, if funding part of the rural health safety net was an issue, a major policy issue, I think you have a strong argument against making raids on the rural health safety net if we had it lined up in order and say this is what the safety net contains. The third issue, which was brought up by Senator Cruz, is a the Area Health Education Center.
Now, tell us what they are and what they
There are four programs, and it's within OHSU, four geographically located AHECs, and they're all in the four corners of the state, so to speak. The idea would be is that they would put together a training program for rural emergency medical technicians, who for the most part are volunteers, for the most part have to pay for their own training and education. And it was beginning to become a burden on some of them, and it's becoming more difficult for the rural areas to recruit volunteer EMTs. Well, last session in 2003, that money disappeared in some other legislative priority. The $600,000 that the Office of Rural Health got was provided for grants, $300,000 a year for grants for rural emergency medical service programs, and they provided grants to purchase radios, a couple of ambulances, et cetera, because the local communities could not support that kind of capital expenditures. And it was working great for about 4 years, and then last session the whole 1.2 went a different direction. And it's my belief that if we would establish a rural health, sustainable rural health safety net, we could use that as a priority, and you could use that, and future legislators could use that as a priority to maintain the funding and the importance of these rural health programs. Secondly, you heard John Zier talk about the need for some of the rural health clinics. There is a shortage, as you also heard David talk about, a shortage of all kinds of rural health providers. And we have to increase the number of primary care physicians, primary care providers in rural Oregon. The rural health safety nets fill a very important role in doing that. Two sessions ago, we had a $3 million bill that came out of then Representative Cruz's committee, supported by Senator Morissette, that would have appropriated $3 million for rural health safety nets. It went to Ways and Means Committee towards the end of the session and was appropriated for some other priority of some other legislators. Again, if funding part of the rural health safety net was an issue, a major policy issue. I think you have a strong argument against making raids on the Rural Health Safety Net if we had it lined up in order and say this is what the safety net contains. The third issue, which was brought up by Senator Cruz, is the creation of the Rural Health Viability Funds in 2001. You recall that. It was a result of the tour that the legislators, including two of them that are here, we made over in Eastern Oregon and on the Southern Coast. The Rural Health Association was already in place and has been around for about 12 years, a volunteer group. The Rural Health Viability Grants were established in statute, and there was a $15 million fund that was attached to that back in 01. But the $15 million, although it was appropriated and it came out of the MUPO funds, was never appropriated to the Rural Health Association.
Now, the MUPO funds, that's an interesting word.
It's not a word.
It's not a word. It's, it's one that we banned from our dictionary, but right. It's used all the time. Could you explain the federal funds that we received that went for something other than they were intended for?
Without getting too much detail, legal detail, the MUPL stands for Medicaid Upper Payment Limits.
Right.
And there is a federal regulation that says any state who doesn't pay up to this maximum limit for Medicaid has a right to obtain the difference in funds. And there was I can't remember the exact number, but about $100 million the state obtained that way through the leadership of the Oregon Association of Hospitals. And the appropriation was made of the $15 million from the $100 million, but then the funds were never released by the administration until the next session, at which time they took the $15 million out of the funding for that. And that is an important part of the safety net, because the whole design for that was to meet some emergency needs that small rural clinics may have, that small rural hospitals who didn't have the capacity to replace or renovate their systems would have access to some of those funds on a grant basis. And what I am proposing in this bill for Senator Morissette's consideration is that we appropriate at least $5 million. I won't say $15 million like we had originally, but $5 million would obtain seed money. We would become seed money for obtaining grants, both private and public fund grants, to build up that fund so we have a trust fund that can be used for that purpose. My association has already gone to the point of establishing a trust within the association with the type of leadership and legal counsel, et cetera, et cetera. We've done that, and we're ready for it, and it's there if there was some motivation to kick it off the ground. So combine those three components along with the preamble, as the fourth component, would be what we would call a rural health safety net.
Good. Questions? Thank you very much, Ed.
Thank you.
This is something that we're working on, and Senator Cruz has been involved in this longer than I have, and we did tour 14 rural clinics, rural facilities, anyway, from hospitals to clinics to nursing homes in rural Oregon and the coastal area, and that made a lasting impression on me and on others who were on the trip. And so we, and working with Ms. Whitaker, who was under the auspices of OHSU for rural health, they've had a huge cut in their budget, and we're looking for ways to create a sustainability fund that would be able to attract grants and gifts and federal money and state money over time to sustain what John is talking about and others in rural Oregon, which we really, really need. So thank you very much for responding to those concerns.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, Ed was talking about the $15 million, and that was hard negotiations, and it was an agreement signed in blood.
Yeah.
But it seems that in Salem, blood runs rather thin from time to time. So, and, you know, the economy changed. We have a new administration. There's all sorts of things. And when we, it was then Senator Fisher was the co-chair of the interim health committee two sessions ago when we did the tour of rural Oregon, and it opened a lot of eyes. But as Ed said, Senator Morissette and I are the only two people left that were on that tour. You know, we're clearly a state that needs term limits because everybody leaves anyway. But it is a real challenge for us to get urban folks to understand the dynamic of life in rural America from time to time. So,
thank you.
Okay, good. John Kaplan, would you please come up? John is with the social services. Social service issues in coastal Oregon. John, would you?
Janet. I'm sorry, Janet.
Okay. Janet. Lincoln County Health and Human Services.
For the record, it's Jan Kaplan. I don't mind John. I get the letters addressed to Ms. I'm the director of the Lincoln County Health and Human Service Department, which is the county public health and behavioral health services, also the director of the County Commission on Children and Families. Prior to my testimony, just for information purposes, we have applied to create a federally qualified health center, and in fact submitted our second application this past December. And that's been a partnership between the both community hospitals, the public health department, our school district, AHEC, are trying to create a model here that would provide primary care services both in Newport and in Lincoln City in our existing public health clinics, expanding those, and would also include 4 school-based health centers. So we are keeping our fingers crossed, but keeping a wary eye in terms of the federal budget.
Chad, Karen, are you aware of that?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So I'll move into my testimony.
Okay.
I've been invited to try to give you a picture of human service needs and challenges on the Oregon coast, and I'll do my best to give you some insights, hopefully, into the needs of children, families, and adults and seniors.
No, excuse me, Jan, you're not going to read all this, right?
I'm going to try not to.
Good. I think there's about
Nine
pages. You will summarize. And we have the testimony, which we'll...
one of my goals was to try to give you a picture of the Oregon coast. It's a very distinct area and that often does not get attention. Mm-hmm. Because of the nature as a region, we don't relate to each other along the coast. Most of our service systems run east-west, in fact, because that's where the hospitals are, that's where our MHOs are, that's where... And it's hard to even elucidate some of the statistical information because it's hard to get really accurate pictures of coastal Lane and coastal Douglas. We can get a demographics on Lane County or Douglas County, but not the coastal area. And the coastal area is very distinctly different from other parts of the state in that... In its disproportions, 25 along the coast from Tillamook down, in general, at least 25% of our populations are over the age of 60, compared to 16% for the state. That's very significant. And 48 in Lincoln County, 48.5% of our citizens are over the age of 45. Compared to 38.5% in the rest of the state. So it creates some very interesting differences in terms of how to approach problems.
Now, the projection is probably for an increase in those populations as well.
That would be expected. The one factor, and that's not in this testimony, but I would mention it, is that we have, in terms of our younger population, that is a growing, particularly population of Hispanic community, that 15% of our 0-5 population in Lincoln County is Hispanic. And that was something I discovered recently, in fact, in preparing the FQHC grant, because we've always seen that total in the county, the Hispanic population is 4%. Which
now,
is
you're using acronyms again.
The qualified
JAM. Well, for the people out here.
The federally qualified.
Yes, thank you.
Right. Thank you for reminding me.
We know what it is, but a lot of people.
So that will also be a challenge to human services on the coast, is that we will have a growing population of our younger folks, families, at the same time as a growing population, people like myself who move here after they're 45. We have an influx of people in their 40s and 50s, and very few people in their 20s and 30s. That's another significant factor in trying to understand coastal dynamics, is that we have an outflux. I'll be leaving here this afternoon to travel to Seattle to see my daughter, who just left home in September to go to college. A large number of our success-oriented young people leave the coast after high school, leave for college, leave for careers, leave for the military. The smaller percentage of folks who remain are primarily working in low-income jobs in the tourism and service industries, have no health insurance or very minimal health insurance, and so we have a skewed population. We don't have a middle class in those, and that contributes to that rates that we see. The coastal counties in general appear to have the highest rates of child abuse, the highest rates of teen pregnancy in the state by far. But when we compare 5,000 Lincoln County people in their 20s and 30s demographically to an average 5,000 in another area, we're not looking at the same populations, and it presents some very unique challenges to us, and something that I believe the state needs to try to pay some more attention to, in terms of we're solving different problems here, and they do consume a lot of our health resources. As a public health director, I consider child abuse to be one of the most critical public health issues that faces us. I'll try to move along today. You're not pushing me hard.
I'm pushing.
Okay. I would echo what David spoke to. The Oregon Health Plan is critically important along the coast, perhaps more so than other parts of the state, because of the disproportions in our population. Lincoln County has 1.3% of the state's total population. But we receive 1.7% approximately of OHP funds, because, again, of that dynamic I discussed we have more folks who are in need of that, and therefore changes to the health plan downward disproportionately impact our health systems, our mental health systems, because we lose more when the cuts to standard have had a devastating effect on the coast. And in some ways, again, that affect all kinds of human services, because prior to those cuts, our mental health department was able to be doing far more outreach in areas. We had people on site at the Children's Advocacy Center to deal with abused children. We had more people outreach. We had a full-time person working at community corrections doing early intervention with that population. The cuts that we sustained, which equaled 5 staff, forced cutbacks in things that really prevent long-term costs to the major health system. So I would echo the health plan itself is critical to our county. Also, in terms of the fact that we have the highest enrollment in the health plan in this county, in this state, I believe, or one of the highest. It's over 14% of our population. Over 16% of our population has no insurance whatsoever, and of the remaining 70%, many of them have very inadequate insurance. And so when they present at our hospitals, again, as that increase in the numbers of indigent puts pressures on all of the healthcare business, because you can't just turn people away. It's one of the reasons that we're pursuing the Federally Qualified Health Center, or FQHC. because that would allow, because that contains funding to serve people who have no funds. And I would also urge you as a committee, and urge the our Senate. There are currently proposals being worked on in Washington that would radically change the Medicaid program, and would perhaps eliminating optional services and optional populations. I would urge you to become knowledgeable about that as quickly as possible, and to work with our congressional leaders, particularly since both of our senators serve on the Senate Finance Committee, to make the needs of this state known, because that could be devastating in terms of, again, the discussions before around the dollars that we leverage in federal dollars for Medicaid, and the potential impact of the changes, as best that I understand them, could be more devastating than the cutbacks that we experienced in this state in the last biennium in terms of the impact. Also, related to the health plan and services, we're currently in this county dealing with an outbreak of pertussis, as Lane County is and Benton County are. And without Medicaid revenues, and we're able, in Oregon, local health departments, particularly around essential services, are primarily funded by local funds and federal funds that pass through the state with relatively small amount of state general fund. We can barely afford and do maintain one full-time communicable disease nurse. With 14 cases of pertussis in various locations spread through the county, we've had to make 200 personal contacts with folks who had contacts with folks with that pertussis, prescribed medications for 82, have to do follow-up with each of those people. The only way that our health department and other health departments have been able to handle that type of situation is we pull nurses from other parts of our operation who are funded in other ways, and we have trained them, and that's our emergency preparedness. But when we have cuts to things like Medicaid or other state funds, that diminishes that emergency reserve. And we've been trying to assure, I've got 8 nurses who have been running their tails off, basically, all weekend, to try to cover this situation. And pertussis is although a serious disease, there are certainly far more deadly diseases that can things like measles or SARS that could affect us at any time, and we try to be prepared for. I'll try to wrap up. I wanted to try to again make you aware of, because I was asked to try to describe human service systems, and I think one of the challenges for you, or for state-level policymakers, is when you look at counties and say, this doesn't make any sense, what are they doing over here? It doesn't look like what they're doing over there. At least I suspect that thought may sometimes cross your minds. And one of the strengths of Oregon and one of the strengths of the coast is the uniqueness of our local service systems, the partnerships that emerge locally. But are different the way that local people solve problems and collaborate together to do that is not a cookie cutter. And so if you get oriented to one county and you look at another, it doesn't make any sense. An example of this that I wanted to stress is this county's school-based health centers, which have been longstanding and which we have struggled to maintain, and were one of the prime motivators for us pursuing the federally qualified health designation. We run 4 school-based health centers, one in each of the county high schools that outreach to the middle and primary schools. Through a cockamamie partnership between the county public health, county behavioral health, the county school district, the ESD, major assistance from our hospitals, all kinds of a number of agencies that collaborate together, Nurse practitioners provide 2 days a week of primary care services in each of them. Behavioral health specialists provide 2 days a week of counseling in each of them. Family advocates link kids to all kinds of medical services. We arrange dental services similarly to what John described in Yaz through various programs. Last year, over 1,200 students of an enrollment of under 6,000 received services in these centers. This community really rallied when the funding for those centers was cut in the past biennium. It really with the help of both the Siletz tribe, numerous foundations locally, real committedness of our staff and of our community groups have been able to maintain and keep them open. The governor in this year's budget has proposed a modest funding increase, and more importantly, not cutting further to school-based health centers. We view these as critical gaps in the safety net for adolescents and at-risk adolescents who can't and don't access health care in other ways, and would urge your support long-term to continue school-based health centers is very much is critical to the safety net. So I thank you again very much for your and particularly for coming here. That's much appreciated.
Thank you. And I've been looking through the testimony, and it's very good. I mean, it's information that we need.
I hope it's
helpful. And the thing that one of the things that I got is that you're east-west oriented. You're not north-south oriented. So, you know, Florence may not, with different kinds of programs, because they're looking at, you know, the Valley, Eugene, Springfield area, and you've got a different orientation. And so that's something that I will take away from what you said, because that emphasis is important to understand.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Good.
I would recommend, because we never study the region in terms of its problems, so if you've picked that up, I've been successful. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have one more informational speaker, and Joan Wesley, client employer provider. Now, we're getting on to the end of the first hour, so then we're going to hear a bill, and then I want to try to get as many people to test drive as possible with a time limit. So we will ask you to be very brief, and please don't read your testimony. Tell us about it, okay?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Joan Wesley. Mm-hmm. I live in Walport, and I am a home care worker and a member of SEIU Local 503. Now, I have assisted seniors and disability clients for 5 years. I'm one of 320 here in Lincoln County and 13,000 statewide who help give low income elderly and disabled individuals the dignity of receiving the care they need in their homes. The reason to keep us on board are obvious.
Okay, could you stop? Would the workers please stand if you're in the room?
There's several of us here.
Several in the room. Okay, they're standing. Okay, you good. Thank you very much. I just wanted to identify those who were here. Go ahead and continue, please.
Okay. In-home health care saves the state money. It costs the state less money to keep someone in their home than to pay for nursing home care. In-home health care in rural areas is even more essential. Here on the coast, health care workers make up the sixth largest employer in Lincoln County. We're bigger than Salishan or Pacific Shrimp. If you know those, there's a lot of people work for them.
Well, you've educated a lot of people on the island.
Yeah. Well, I myself was educated on this just recently. I did not know that 320 comprised a large group of employees.
Right.
It is also essential here in this rural area because of the disproportionate number of senior citizens on the coast. 20% of the population is 65 and older in Lincoln County, in Lincoln and Tillamook counties, compared to with just 13% statewide. Another 12% of the people on the coast are from 55 to 64. And we say, who's going to take care of them in the future? Despite the obvious needs that I've just mentioned, there are moves afoot to deny several thousand people in the state of Oregon of this service. Furthermore, the governor is proposing to deny many of the remaining clients the right to select a provider of their own choice. You see, our providers get to interview us and select us. In-home care allows clients to live with dignity in their own home, and nothing can destroy our clients' dignity more than being unable to choose those who will help them with bathing, toileting, and other personally intimate needs. These changes will impact us, all of us workers, in a number of ways. And I say all of us, too, not just us as workers, but all of you, because people who do this work privately get their start in seniors and disability services. Most of you in this room will at some time, and we workers know this more than anyone else, sometime in the future, you will need to hire a home care worker. Where are you going to find that good worker? Soon there will be, they say, there's going to be a 7% increase in people over 85 years old in this county. Where will you find that good worker? I'm appealing to you today to help us get what we need as workers. Our jobs are being threatened now, and we are losing heart. We are frustrated and angry. And I can tell you, I personally am frustrated and angry. And the root cause of my distress and our distress is the lack of respect for this work and for the workers. And this is reflected in three areas. The first one is lack of training. We attend only one orientation when we are hired. There is no ongoing training for a job that requires many skills. In fact, you could probably name about 100 skills that we need to have. There is no training for us to do our job safely. We lift people in and out of bed and the bathtub almost every day. We want to make sure that we do not injure ourselves or our clients. Yet this problem seems to be a low priority. There are no meetings for policy updates. In rural areas, people are spread out, and there is no structure that ensures that we as workers get the training that we need. The second area of concern is pay and benefits. Under the union contract, for the first time, home care workers are covered if they are hurt on the job. This is as of April of this year. We also have individual-only health insurance. But the state is threatening to take away workers' comp because SAFE says it is marginally more expensive than they had estimated. We are saying we should have had workers' comp from the beginning when this program was started many years ago. These workers did not have workers' comp, and I worked for 4.5 years without workers' comp. Our health insurance has been a lifesaver. And personally, I know of 3 home care workers who told me that because they have health insurance, more than anyone else. Sometime in the future, you will need to hire a home care worker. Where are you going to find that good worker? Soon there will be, they say, there's going to be a 7% increase in people over 85 years old in this county. Where will you find that good worker? I'm appealing to you today to help us get what we need as workers. Our jobs are being threatened now, and we are losing heart. We are frustrated and angry. And I can tell you, I personally am frustrated and angry. And the root cause of my distress and our distress is the lack of respect for this work and for the workers. And this is reflected in three areas. The first one is lack of training. We attend only one orientation when we are hired. There is no ongoing training for a job that requires many skills. In fact, you could probably name about 100 skills that we need to have. There is no training for us to do our job safely. We lift people in and out of bed and the bathtub almost every day. We want to make sure that we do not injure ourselves or our clients. Yet this problem seems to be a low priority. There are no meetings for policy updates. In rural areas, people are spread out, and there is no structure that ensures that we as workers get the training that we need. The second area of concern is pay and benefits. Under the union contract, for the first time, home care workers are covered if they're hurt on the job. This is as of April of this year. We also have individual-only health insurance. But the state is threatening to take away workers' comp because SAFE says it is marginally more expensive than they had estimated. We are saying we should have had workers' comp from the beginning when this program was started many years ago. These workers did not have workers' comp, and I worked for 4.5 years without workers' comp. Our health insurance has been a lifesaver. And personally, I know of 3 home care workers who told me that because they have health insurance, they were diagnosed and treated for medical problems early before they became life-threatening or disabling. One of those workers is with us today. With a net pay of about $8 an hour, we have little money to maintain safe and reliable vehicles, which are necessary on these rural roads. We are without pay when we are sick and have our own appointments to go to. It seems that we are expected to work in an altruistic manner. But how can we when our basic necessities are not met? And then the third area of concern is the inability to work in partnership with my client's case manager. Due to DHS budget cuts and heavy loads, I met the case manager for my disability client for the first time just recently. I have served this client for 5 years. I literally have hands-on knowledge of my client's needs. And so we should be partnering with these case managers, not working in isolation. Instead of devoting more resources to direct care, the governor is proposing to add a layer of unneeded bureaucracy to the system that will decrease the quality of care that my client receives. These demands that we have to you are about justice. Reward us with this respect that we demand, and we will reward you with good home care workers of the future. Thank you for this opportunity for us to come and talk to you today.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Montezano.
Yes, just a comment. My mother needed home care services, and we did put her, actually ended up putting her in the foster care. But before she went into foster care, we did have home care, and they are vital to keeping our elderly, particularly in the homes, and we do value your work. I want you to know I at least value your work.
Okay, yeah, you're one of 320 in Lincoln County, and there are 13,000 statewide. Is that correct?
Yes.
You said that
yes.
Earlier. Yeah. And I know that you do have a collective bargaining. You're not state employees, but you do have a collective bargaining contract that, so you're able to get health care and other kinds of things
yes.
through collective bargaining.
And we get a W-2 every year.
Okay.
So. We are.
Now, I see this as a cost shift. If we cut your program, then more money will be spent in other more expensive programs, and people will have to be taken care of at some level, and I think that you are providing a hugely valid or valuable service that I totally support, and I commend you for your dedication, because it's one of the occupations I think you have to be dedicated to go into and to do the day-to-day grind and the heavy lifting and the travel without compensation and so on. So I applaud you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, moving right along. We are going to have a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 98, and I will open the public hearing. Would you like to discuss the bill, please?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 98 allows the Department of Services to delegate licensing functions to adult foster homes for elderly and disabled persons to Type B Area Agency on Aging, exempt adult foster homes in counties that have been the bill also exempts adult foster homes in counties that have been exempted. Briefly, and we do have somebody here to present on this as well. Adult foster homes are individual private residences licensed to provide care for five or fewer individuals. Currently, they're licensed and monitored by the Area Agency on Aging. There are approximately 2,500 adult foster homes in Oregon that provide care to more than 10,000 individuals. Area Agency on Aging, or AAAs, are categorized as type A and B. This really is dependent on what kinds of programs they operate and kind of services they provide to their local community. Right now, Clackamas and Multnomah are the only two counties that are currently exempt from this bill because of their local ordinances. Thank you, Senator.
Cindy, how do you explain it before I can't review this?
Cindy Hanna. Would you give us your... Go ahead, introduce yourself.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Cindy Hannum, and I am over the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care for seniors and people with disabilities. Actually, this is just a housekeeping bill. What we have been advised by Justice Department is in ORS 410, where all of the responsibilities for area agencies are. It does not explicitly state that they are allowed to do foster home licensing. We have been doing this for 17 years, so it is...
Forgive me.
That's all right.
I was looking for copies of the bill.
Senator Starr always comes prepared.
Senator Starr comes prepared. Okay.
So this is related to ORS 410. And what it does is it adds under Section 2 that local area agencies on aging, we can actually delegate from DHS that they can do the inspections, issue the licenses, renew the license, do any sort of complaint investigations, and all of the sanction activity remains with state office. Seniors and seniors and people with disabilities. It also makes clear in Section 2 that this does not change in any way ORS 443780, which allows for county ordinance, and that would be Multnomah County and Clackamas County. So, again, this is exactly what we are doing now. There is no change whatsoever. There is no cost to the bill.
Thank you.
All right. If I may, Mr. Chair, the one thing we failed to do, and we actually need this bill passed under a emergency clause because the Area Agency on Aging contracts are up in July, and we failed to do this in the bill, so we would need a dash one amendment.
Good.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming we could probably have that by
our next week.
By next week.
Yeah.
Emergency clauses are easy.
So we're going to have a workshop.
No.
Okay.
It's awful early in the session to be doing conceptual things.
Now, thank you very much. We're not going to do a work session on this past bill because we don't have that amendment. But I think many of you are here for other issues concerning adult foster care. And I know there are some issues. One of them is insurance, the liability issue. Now, do we have people who are signed up to do that? Now, what I'd like to do is limit your testimony, individuals who come up to 3 minutes. Yeah, and do we... Yeah, we're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 98. And
these are the providers that you want.
I don't want to provide. Okay, Marjorie Wally. Okay. Yeah, come on, Marjorie. Okay, you're dealing with vision services, and what I would like to do after Marjorie is deal with some of the concerns of the foster providers. Raise your hand if you are a foster home provider, please. Okay, there are some of you here. I want to hear from you. So we will do that next. I don't know if you signed up or not, but we want to hear from the foster care providers. So go ahead.
My name is Marge Whaley, and thank you for this opportunity to talk to you. I believe that we need more vision coverage on the Oregon Health Plan and on the PLUS program. I have a daughter that... this is blind in one eye, and she's on a standard right now, barely. And she has is losing her eye, and in the future she'll have to have an operation on that eye. And my fears are there's not going to be any coverage to cover that.
Okay.
I recently went through a thing, it wasn't vision, but I have a daughter that has a cyst and carpal tunnel who needs an operation, and since she doesn't have insurance, she will not be getting that operation because she needs therapy and that. So I have one child that's not getting what she needs, and I fear for my other one. And I also have vision issues too, and also hearing issues. And I would like that that we keep the Oregon Health Plan, or we have some kind of insurance that small business, poor people, and poor working people will be able to have coverage, because it's awful to see somebody suffering and you can't do anything about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Sir, would you like to come over and testify? I'm just going to call people up and identify yourselves, and I do want to hear from foster care providers because that was one of the issues. You're a foster care provider? Okay. Go ahead. Introduce yourself, and we'd like to take about 2 to 3 minutes to summarize, if you would. Just give us a brief.
My name is Krupa Rao Kancharlak. I'm from Astoria, Oregon.
Okay.
And I'm here to share some of my views about the liability insurance.
Okay, good. That's what we want to hear.
The liability insurance, maybe 10 years ago, it was around $500. And today, the liability insurance, you can't believe how much it went up. And if you have somebody in a wheelchair, somebody who cannot, in a bed, or somebody from a developmentally disabled agency or from mental health, it varies from person to person. And it is between $6,000 to $7,000. Most of the foster homes in Astoria doesn't have a liability insurance. I believe it is all over Oregon. And recently we got a call from Salem. They're trying to work out on some of the issues, and we received some information. It is around between $2,000 to $3,000 liability insurance. And it is very hard, and we are not able to pay our own health insurances at this time for our families. And also the liability insurance, barely we are having the fire insurance and liability. Only one home in Astoria, Clatsop County, they have a liability insurance, because we are not able to afford it. And I hope
it's an issue that we're aware of. I'm aware of that, and we're working very hard to try to solve that problem. Cindy, would you come over and sit at the table? And I'm going to have a few other people come up, and if you just sit there. Sir, would you like to move in, either you or your wife?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, and okay, go ahead and identify yourself. And
my name is Fred Albert, and this is my wife, Jane.
Okay.
We're from Salem. We have seven foster care homes in Independence, Salem, and Dallas, Oregon. And we've been fighting this liability insurance for probably 4 years now. We have an agent. He goes after the insurance companies, but it takes them... it's taken them 2 years to find this liability insurance. We recently got insurance on three of our homes in Salem at the cost of about $7,500 a year. But we've had figures as high as $10,000 per house. And taking care of Medicaid people, there just isn't enough dollars to take care of all the expenses plus the employees. And we're one of those minimum wage people are just above that we pay employees. We would always like to pay them more, but it's really hard to do because of issues with liability insurance and different expenses and taking care of people. Jane, do you have anything to say?
I'm sorry. You have to introduce yourself first and then speak into the microphone for the record.
Oh, we recently received a letter from the state that Sparta Insurance out of California would carry liability insurance, but the only people that they wanted to insure was the Medicaid people in the house and not the private pay, but they still wanted to charge $2,500 a year. I have a insurance agent that really does a good job for me, and I would be glad to give you his name. He's been looking for insurance for us like for 4 or 5 years. And we also have residential care facilities, and there we have three of those, and they're around $40,000 a year. So we pay a lot of money, you know, for insurances. It would be nice if we could get some help on changing this situation, because I do remember the day when we paid $650 a year, you know, and that... It always helps to have less expenses because groceries keep going up. And by the way, we have no claims.
You're doing a good job. thank you very much. Other, yes, would you please come up and introduce yourself, and then you can come up later and go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairman and Committee. I'm Suzanne Edmiston, and I'm from McMinnville, Oregon. We have 4 adult foster care homes, none of them owner-occupied. We're a Level 2 home. We're licensed by the state. We just had our relicensing earlier this week, which is why I don't have anything in writing for you. But I'm happy to be here. Our concerns are similar to what this gentleman expressed. Our liability insurance for 4 homes went from $4,500 to $15,000 in a heartbeat 4 years ago. We've had several different carriers because of their conditions. We have people who are elderly. We have people who are in the mental health program. Some of the insurance carriers will not let us have people who are in the mental health program. They deny us, or another carrier denied us if they could be in the mental health program, but they had to be same sex in the same house, which at that time we were able to accommodate. Currently, we are without professional liability insurance. We're not able to find it anywhere. We also contacted SPARTA, and SPARTA told us something slightly different than what this gentleman shared, in that if we did not have 100% Medicaid in our home, we would not be eligible. If we had one private pay resident in our home, we were excluded, and that is our situation. We were excited to hear that you might be raising our Medicaid rates to be the same as the assisted living.
care.
Would you like to respond to this, please?
Well, not really.
Okay.
No.
Introduce yourself again, please.
Okay. Well, once again, my name's Cindy Hannum, and I actually am over the regulations of all of these facilities for
DHS. So you're the one.
I'm
the person. Don't let her out.
Everything everyone has said is basically true. This is a terrible problem. Now, we have been working with the insurance division, DCBS, the governor's office, risk management. We did find Sparta. This is true. This was a California insurance company that actually insured lots of small businesses. And they came to Oregon, and we had somewhat of a miscommunication because they were under the impression that the residents in foster homes in Oregon were much less impaired than they actually are. As you know, the Oregon model, we have as high of impairment in home settings, community-based care settings, as any state in the country. That's been the hallmark for Oregon. And it's very hard for the insurance industry to grapple with because they basically want to look at medical, and if it looks like a nursing home, smells like a nursing home, tastes like a nursing home type of thing, then they want to put it into that category. So they don't really recognize community-based care in the same way that our public policy does. What happened with Sparta is they totally withdrew from the market. At first, their basic position was folks have to be ambulatory, self-evacuate. That's true of many folks, but we have dementia in these homes, we have mobility impairments, and it is expected that the providers assist them. So that was a problem. The second problem was they would only provide insurance if it was either all Medicaid or we amended the licensing rules to require liability insurance. And I would not do that without legislative direction to do so because there's a cost factor there. So we're out of luck with Sparta. They have withdrawn from Oregon. Where we are now, there will be two insurance bills that come forward that have to do with homeowners insurance. No one mentioned here, but we have heard concerns that people have been losing their homeowners insurance because they haven't had liability or they have put more stipulations on homeowners because of the type of folks who were living there. So those bills are being finalized and are going to be proposed.
Now, I understand that if a person uses their homeowner insurance for a business, they are immediately canceled.
If the insurance carrier knows about that, that will probably occur. Or if they file a claim and they find out, it will not be honored.
Right. That's so we have a problem in this industry, which is, I think, one of the best industries that we have for dealing with the problems of aging.
Absolutely.
And so, thank
you. We're trying very hard.
Good. Thank you. Velma Hartwig.
Thank you. I wasn't really expecting to be up here, but the problem...
You signed the sheet.
No, I sent him a note. the concern that I have is related in a way. It's not about the nursing homes, but are you aware that the quick responders the volunteers have horrible insurance costs. And that's our biggest problem. We live in East County. We cover, I would say, probably 200 or 300 square miles of territory with very few people in it.
Now, where is your location?
Okay, I live in Harlan.
Okay.
You probably came out, some of you out Highway 20. When you came across the county line and until you got to the 15-mile post, which is near Toledo, that's just one direction and approximately the same the other direction. So there's a lot of territory, a lot of highway. Highway 20 has approximately 2 accidents a week on that road. I mean, we'll have sometimes 3 or 4 one week and none the next, but it averages out about 2 a week. And many of those are very serious accidents. And besides that, we have a lot of loggers out where we are. And they respond to those. In fact, 3 of our neighbors have been injured in the past year in logging accidents. One of them almost killed me. And those people are there first, and they'll be there as much as an hour before anybody gets there. And you've heard about the magic hour with the, either an injury or heart attack or whatever. And they are the ones who will usually save their lives. And they have to raise their own money in most cases. I mean, why should people that go out on those emergency calls have to have dinners in the school and have auctions and have all kinds of activities to raise money in addition to what they're doing? I mean, these are wonderful people. They came out when my son broke his back, and I would be very, very happy to put anybody in their hands. And as I say, this is not related to home care, but it is a very serious problem.
Okay. We're here now to hear whatever problems people have in relation to health care.
And, of course, they also many times have to raise money for their training. Occasionally, they do get a grant or something to train a quick responder or an EMT. And there are several stages. You go through the first, you're a quick responder, then you're graded up again, and then you're graded up again until you get to the point where you're an EMT. So it takes a lot of training and a lot of time, a lot of volunteering. They pay their own gas. No, they don't ask for any money. They buy the, most of the time they buy their own equipment, which, you know, people don't have that kind of money. But that was one of the things I wanted to tell you.
Well, I appreciate that, and we did run into that when we took our trip. I think it was Sumter where they Granite, okay, where they have 2 ambulances, and they fund the ambulances with a bake sale once a year. That's where they fund their ambulances, and that's right out in eastern Oregon, literally in the middle of nowhere, so to speak.
Right.
And during the winter and during hunting season, they are the first responders.
Right.
And it's
right. Well,
admirable.
We have basically the same problems they do in eastern Oregon because of the rural area that we live in.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Karen, would you
Thank you, Senator Morissette, and members of the committee. I just want to
go ahead and give your name again.
Oh, I'm Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the OHSU Center for Rural Health. I just wanted to add to what she had to say, you know, the EMS enhancement account that Ed Patterson referred to. We used to use those funds to pay liability insurance for these quick response teams and to pay for their training and to pay for their equipment. And, of course, as Ed said, that money has vanished. So reinstating those funds would be so important to these small volunteer agencies. We had times when they would contact us and say, we can't operate anymore because we've lost our liability insurance. And we were able to just write them a check and pay for their insurance and keep them in operation. So these funds would be so important to reinstate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Russell Faria.
Yes. About 3 minutes. Dr. Russ Ferry, I'm a family physician here in town, private physician. I think you've heard about 3, 4, 5 people come here and talk about some of their problems. And what did you hear over and over again? Liability insurance. Liability insurance. Liability insurance. You get the picture?
Mm-hmm.
Liability insurance. The people of Oregon spoke with Measure 35 this past November. They made it clear that they would rather sue doctors than have doctors. And they are well on their way to getting their wish. And that ain't, I'm not saying that. Yeah. Listen to the people around here talking about the workforce problems in rural Oregon. The people that voted against Measure 35 were mostly Multnomah County, Metro Portland, all of rural Oregon voted for Measure 35. Okay, now, Portland doesn't see a problem because OHSU, the medical school, limits its total liability to $500,000. We're trying to limit pain and suffering for private physicians. So if I'm a private physician here in Newport and I get a medical accident, I could be sued for $1 million, $10 million, whatever the jury wants. OHSU, if I were Professor Farry of Family Practice at OHSU, the most you could get out of me in the entire institution is $500,000 total. Even I think that's low. But that's what the state of Oregon has decided in their infinite wisdom through the legislature, and for some reason that's constitutional, but it's not constitutional if it's done for private physicians. Okay. Now, the tax credit, what's going to help? It's not just the physicians, because you're hearing that with the first responders, et cetera. Yeah. Okay. Relax. I'm going to give you some...
Relax, and we're going to give you some time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know.
I apologize too, because I think that what you're saying is applicable to everyone here.
Exactly.
It's a very important point. So I want you to take your time and explain it, and we will try to do something.
I'm hurrying too because I have to be in my office.
Oh, okay.
I actually have real life patients I got to go see. About
you're not hurrying because I told you to.
No, I got to hurry because I got to be here about 3:00. All right.
Okay.
And now you know the tax credit helps. What is it, $5,000 now, going up to $10,000, something like that. Now, you do understand here that dollar value of that tax credit is going straight to my malpractice insurance bill. So it's nice, thank you very much, but it's just going right around. Now, there is a subsidy for our malpractice insurance that came through this past year. Courtesy of our governor and our legislature, and I think it's about 40% for people like me if you're doing obstetrics, it's 60%, something like that. That is very nice, and I would like to thank the taxpayers of this area who seem to, through business, through SAFE, etc., are paying for this whole system rather than paying physicians, to try and recruit them to this area, haven't been able to get an internist here for 3 years, etc. You know, this money's just going straight into the system. You do understand that subsidy is going to evaporate in a couple of years. When that evaporates in a couple of years, we're going to get a premium increase of at least 40%. Really, it's going to be more like 50 or 60 or 70% because you'll get that year's premium rise plus the 40% or 50% or 60%. So you'll see some $10,000 or $20,000 increase for a primary doc like me, and probably, I'm going to guess, about 3 or 4 times that much if you're an obstetrician all at once.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, let me point out, because I helped create that it was done as a pilot, which we do a lot of these things as a pilot, and if pilots prove to be successful and they prove to be beneficial, they're in most cases extended. So it wasn't done as something meant to disappear. It was done as something that needed to prove itself. That was the way we could get the votes for it. So
if the money keeps on, if the money continues to exist, we seem to be having problems finding money for a whole bunch of things in this state. If and I think right now it came out of SAFE or something like that, as I recall. So hey, if you can find the money, fine. That's fine with me. Now there are. Obviously, the limit on liability as proposed, contemplated in Measure 35 was voted down by the people of the state, so we can't do much as far as that's concerned. There are other things that can be done, and a lot of this has been brought up through the State Medical Association. OHSU somehow manages to exempt themselves from the rules that the rest of us have to live under. Maybe there is some way that rural physicians can be considered agents of OHSU for the purpose of malpractice. There are certain procedural things in trials that I don't know if the committee can contemplate that or not, but it's been brought up. Pre-trial disclosure of witnesses. I think we're one of two states in the whole country that don't allow that. You know, you can just bring in an expert. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't understand all the ins and outs, but there are certain idiosyncrasies of how malpractice trials are done in this state, that there are maybe one or two states in the whole country that still do it. Joint and several liability, if I were to, for example, refer a patient into this hospital and there was some act of malpractice of which maybe I was responsible for 1% of it and the hospital is responsible for 99% of it, if the hospital somehow manages to get off or settle it somehow, I could be responsible for 100% of the liability, joint and several liability. I'm bringing these things up because I thought I have to explain it to the group. There are things like that that possibly could be done, or, you know, just like the physicians, the first responders, etc., are going to be litigated or insured, whatever, lack of insured, out of business. You do know we are about one neurosurgeon away from losing trauma center out in Medford. You do that, then you have nobody in Southern Oregon. Mm-hmm. And you won't be able to get head trauma care at all unless you can figure out a way to get somebody up to Portland in an hour.
Yeah. Life fights like that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll go back to work, please. We need you. Ray Burley, would you please come forward?
That was good.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Ray Burley. I'm the executive director of a program called the Olalla Center in Toledo. The Olalla Center is a psychiatric day treatment program for young kids between the ages of 3 and 13. I'm here because of a budget note, and I'm really here kind of in a state of panic, and maybe the panic is deserved, and maybe it's my own fantasy, I don't know. But the budget note creates the Children's Mental Health Initiative. And this is a mental health program, if you will, that's spreading and is intended to spread throughout the state of Oregon. So let me take just a second to tell you what psychiatric day treatment is, just so we're all on the same page. Psychiatric day treatment is a day treatment that goes on 5 days a week, 48 weeks a year, for children with severe disabilities, severe emotional problems, severe behavioral problems, suicidal young kids, abused young kids, kids who aren't functioning in school well. The referrals often come from schools, they come from doctors, they come from local mental health folks. The Olalla Center's been in existence since 1972. There's a picture and an article on my wall about 178 local folks who gathered together and went to the legislature and set up this program, and so it's been around a long time. The budget note is concernful because it's happening very quickly, one, and because we're getting information from time to time that the program may have to absorb some cuts. In February of 2003, my program absorbed a 40% cut. So we have a contract with the state of Oregon. We're a nonprofit. We have a contract with the state of Oregon to serve 15 kids a day. 15 disturbed kids a day. And suddenly in February of 2003, we had a contract for 8.6 kids a day. Cut staff, had to tell families that the children couldn't be served anymore. And at the time, I was the family therapist in the program, and so one of my jobs was to go out into the community and explain to the families that even though Johnny had these severe problems, he wasn't going to be served at this time anymore. The other change that's happened, and is, I think, important for the community to understand, is that prior to February of 2003, the Olalla Center could serve anybody in the community, any child in the community between the ages of 3 and 13, if indeed symptoms were severe enough. But after February of 2003, we began serving only children who had the Oregon Health Plan. And so there's a whole group of children in this community and every community throughout the state that aren't getting served. That's one of the issues. Now, in October of 2003, 20% of those funds came back to us. So we went from 8.6, now we're back to 12.9 kids per day. We still had a couple of staff that we couldn't replace and so forth and so on. But it was workable. In that interim period of time, my board of directors had to consider the fact that we needed to sell the building, close the program, and so forth. The rumors that I hear about the Children's Mental Health Initiative is that there's another 25% coming down the road somewhere. And I don't know where that cut whether that cut is real or not. I'm not sure. I've talked to local mental health folks here who are supportive, good folks who regularly participate with us. They're not sure. But the point is that I represent one program, and there's another dozen throughout the state that are just like me, private nonprofits, psychiatric day treatment. We have to have a certain level of worker. We have to have a psychiatrist that works with kids. We have to have liability insurance, too. Everybody's harking on that one. But the reality is that we can't absorb a 25% cut. We won't be here. And we won't be alone. There will be other programs. So I wanted to bring that to the committee's attention.
Mr. Chair, sorry to interrupt. I'm not familiar with the budget note. You say the budget note is going to create another 25% cut.
No, so. No, I wasn't clear. Excuse me. The budget note created an incentive for the state mental health to see if they could repair the system.
Okay.
And so they've put together a series of plans, which are still ongoing, and which the legislature should understand and be a part of, because part of their planning would include some cuts down the line, I'm afraid. And that's what's of concern to me.
Okay. Was this reflected in the governor's budget, or do you know that?
I don't know that.
Okay. I'd be interested in that information. I wasn't familiar with the budget note, and if it, you know, I'm not against planning per se, but I've been an advocate of arts for a long time.
As I understand the Children's Mental Health Initiative, and I certainly don't claim to be an expert, but as I understand it, there are two goals, and the goals are philosophical and reasonable, I think. The goals are that we will serve kids in our home community, that kids won't be sent from Lincoln County to Portland for services, that we will keep kids here. And that's certainly an admirable goal.
Well, that's assuming all communities have DART centers where they can take care of these kids, which isn't the case.
Absolutely true. But the other goal is that we will involve families more intensely than we have in the past, and that's a good goal. These are both philosophically, I think, good goals. How we arrive there is another question entirely. Again, because of time, I want to make sure a couple other points get made.
Sure.
One of those points is that there's also a rumor, and again, it's just a rumor, and I don't know whether these things are true or not, but they scare the heck out of you when you hear them. And that is that the Christie list will be pared down in this process. Now, the Christie list is a pot of money that the legislature set aside, and I was one of the people years and years ago down in Grants Pass that worked on this. The Christie list is a pot of money that legislators set aside for educational purposes for kids when they're in mental health facilities. And there are probably 20 or 22 or 23 organizations around the state that get money to buy a teacher and aides from the Christie list. If the Christie list is cut, there go teachers for mental health programs. They're not teachers for the public schools. They're teachers strictly for the mental health program. And that's of concern. And finally, one of the concerns for me is that right now, a teacher wants to refer a child to the Olalla Center. This child is out of control. This child may be making suicidal statements. This child may be knocking other kids down. This child may be leaving the building without permission. This child may have started a couple of fires in the wastebaskets. All kinds of possibilities exist. But this teacher makes a referral to me or to one of my staff. We meet with the parents involved. We talk with mental health counselors. We talk with the teachers. We make a determination of whether this child is eligible to receive services. But we make that determination as part of a team. We don't make it alone. And yet what I'm hearing as part of the state mental health plan is that an HMO in Corvallis is going to make a decision about our referral process. And it seems to me it's just another layer of bureaucracy that's going to slow things down, going to make it difficult for parents to find services for their kids. And so I think it's something that we should at least be aware of and be talking about. Maybe there's something going on that I don't understand, but that makes me nervous, and thank you for letting me talk about anything.
All right. No, thank you very much. And I've been making notes, and we did have Bob Nickel, who was the director and Senator Monis Anderson's committee, which is also a health committee, which Senator Cruz and I are on. I don't know that we dealt specifically with these issues, but we did have some overviews, and we will, this is new, and we will get answers and get back with you.
Thank you.
We do have your
name,
but do you have a card?
I do.
Something
I do. And I also have a letter here. I had a parent with me, and she was going to testify.
Denise Watkins?
Yes, yeah. She was going to testify, but she wrote something up. She was more prepared than I.
Okay. You did a good job. I really appreciate it. So if you give us the letter, then we'll enter that into the testimony. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just in response, there are a lot of rumors going around, and we have a $1 billion shortfall that we are working with, and there are so many needs out there, and I think every one of us would like to make sure that everyone is not hurt, and we are, but individual testimony from you really brings to attention certain things that are really going to be effective, so thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay, Melody Clemens, comments? Would you come up, please? And then, keep your remarks brief if possible.
Well, I don't have much time.
Oh, you have to go back to work, please.
No, actually, I have my son sitting out in the handicap van. We just came from a wedding, and so I just got a call yesterday to come in, and so yes, I have just a few statements.
Okay. Well, go ahead and give us your name. And
Melody Clements.
And you are?
I'm here for I take care of an adult at home, my son.
Okay.
So to address the residential or the relative home care.
The relative home care is an important issue because I think we're cutting funds on that also, which is very bothersome because these are people, family members who take care of people that otherwise would be maybe in an institution. Go ahead.
Okay, so yes. So basically, point number one is that it saves the state a lot of money. The nursing home is $152 a day, 30 days to a month. $4,560. I get paid $1,150. That saves the state almost $41,000 a year. So yeah, and I asked why they would even think about doing that because it didn't make any sense to me. And I was told that because they assume that because it's a family member, we're going to take care of them anyway. I'm a single mom. Always have been. I have made a lot of adjustments to live on a very limited, small income, but I can't live on no income. So if you take it away, he will have to go into a nursing home. You take away my choice. So basically, that's my main point. Also, the care, you know, of the child. My son has a traumatic brain injury. His neurosurgeon told me that his progress is remarkable, but because he has been taken care of at home. That's about it.
Where do you live, by the way?
I live in Lincoln City on the Siletz River. And I do actually live with my boyfriend, my fiancé, but even if they were to take this away, I still would not be able to keep him at home. He doesn't make enough money to support all three of us. You know, this was a tough choice. I mean, I made a lot of, you know, it was a hard choice for me to do.
I think parents who choose to keep their children at home and care for them make huge sacrifices, oftentimes not being able to work and giving up that.
Well, I have a master's degree.
Yeah,
and
so I understand, you know, the sacrifice. That,
yeah,
the financial
sacrifice. Okay, the financial,
yeah.
Yes, because I mean, but I have made the adjustments to a modest lifestyle, and I'm okay with that.
Okay.
That's my choice. And that's my biggest point here, is that if you take away the funding, you take away my choice. I have no choice than to put him in a nursing home if you take away the funding. And I'm sure that's true of a lot of people that take care of relatives at home. You take away their choice.
Good. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, we're running out of time here. I'm looking more for the people who live in the coast in this area. Are there other people who live in this area? Did you want to come up and testify? Yes, you.
Sort of shaped out.
And then I think somebody else raised their hand, and we're going to... Okay, another fact here. We're going to try to end at 3, and people have to leave it. I will be here to listen, give a testimony, and so on, but go ahead and give us your name.
I'm Sandy Post. I am the director of Shangri-La Corporation in Lincoln County. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Shangri-La is a nonprofit organization. We provide housing, employment, and support services for people with developmental disabilities here in Lincoln County, in Florence and Lane County, and in our largest program is in Marion County. There are just a few points about the situation and issues of people with developmental disabilities and organizations that provide services to them that I wanted to point out. One is that the population of people with developmental disabilities is aging, and with medical advances and the types of service delivery we have now, people are living a lot longer. But that doesn't mean they don't have more complex issues, all the aging issues we have also. So their needs rise, the cost of caring for these folks is increasing, but our funding remains the same. Rates are set for individuals by the state, and throughout their life it pretty much stays the same. And Jan Kaplan, I think some others, pointed out that when you live in a rural area, it's not the same as being in Salem or in Portland. If we have more limited medical services here, if we have to take somebody to Salem or to Portland for medical.
The financial, yes, because I mean, but I have made the adjustments to a modest lifestyle, and I'm okay with that. Okay. That's my choice. And that's my biggest point here, is that if you take away the funding, you take away my choice. I have no choice than to put him in a nursing home if you take away the funding. And I'm sure that's true of a lot of people that take care of relatives at home. You take away their choice.
Good. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're running out of time here. I'm looking more for the people who live in the coast in this area. Are there other people who live in this area? Did you want to come up and testify? Yes, you.
Shake that.
And then I think somebody else raised their hand, and we're going to... Okay, another back there. We're going to try to end at 3, and people have to leave it. I will be here to listen to the testimony and so on, but go ahead and give us your name.
I'm Sandy Post. I am the director of Shangri-La Corporation in Lincoln County. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Shangri-La is a nonprofit organization. We provide housing, employment, and support services for people with developmental disabilities here in Lincoln County, in Florence and Lane County, and in our largest program is in Marion County. There are just a few points about the situation and issues of people with developmental disabilities and organizations that provide services to them that I wanted to point out. One is that the population of people with developmental disabilities is aging, and with medical advances and the types of service delivery we have now, people are living a lot longer. But that doesn't mean they don't have more complex issues, all the aging issues we have also. So their needs rise, the cost of caring for these folks is increasing, but our funding remains the same. Rates are set for individuals by the state, and throughout their life it pretty much stays the same. And Jan Kaplan, I think some others, pointed out that when you live in a rural area, it's not the same as being in Salem or in Portland. If we have more limited medical services here, if we have to take somebody to Salem or to Portland for medical services, that's a full day. Sometimes it's overnight. So the relative costs to us are greater. Rates stay the same. What we're finding now, when we have a vacancy and there are placements or referrals coming from the state, there are people with very, very complex needs, very high psychological and medical needs. And again, the costs are high because if we are going to take those people, we have to transport them a greater distance. Our staffing needs, our staffing costs and our transportation costs are very high. This equates to the need for more highly skilled caregivers. And I think we share a lot of the issues of some of the other providers that you've listened to. There has not been a cost of living adjustment for 5 years for caregivers in DD homes. So I guess I would urge you, I don't guess, please, I pray, I urge you to make a cost of living adjustment possible for caregivers. And those are the points I will leave you with now.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I'm Cleo Circle.
Now, speak into the microphone, please.
I'm Cleo Circle, and I'm from Depot Bay. I care for my 51-year-old daughter who has mental and physical problems. And at this time, I'm receiving... that money to care for her, and I'm so afraid you're going to cut it off, and I have just Social Security, I spent all my savings trying to, hopefully I thought she would be all right. It just hasn't worked that way. They're going to have to invent something for her. And I just wanted to beg you to think in terms of, don't shut us out. So I just don't know what would happen to her. She's agoraphobic, and she would have to be in a care home if I can't do it. And I would certainly like to do it as long as I can stand.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead and state your name, please.
My name's Rachel Elliott. Excuse me. I have Enchanted Gardens Foster Care Home in Florence, Oregon.
Okay.
And I belong to ACPU. I know I've seen some of you at our meetings, and I appreciate it. Anyway, specifically talking about the liability insurance, we used to have approximately 20 homes in Florence, foster care homes.
Wow.
In the Florence area. We have 6 now. We had 7 about 3 weeks ago, but now we're 6. I own one. My husband runs another. So basically, you're seeing a third of the foster care homes in Florence right here. We had a few months ago, one of our homes was owned and ran by the local discharge planner at our hospital, who's an RN. Wonderful person, her and her husband. She couldn't get insurance. And that was finally, there were a lot of issues, but that was finally the, you know, straw that broke the camel's back with her, and she just said, you know, I've tried, I can't do it. And we lost a wonderful foster care provider with her, an RN, you know, just hurt.
Yeah.
I started this program, in this program 20 years ago, 2 years after the beginning of it,
mm-hmm.
So I've seen many changes. I have never filed a claim. I have never filed an insurance claim. Not for my car, not for my house, not for liability. No, not, my husband hasn't, my children haven't, none of my seniors have. And yet, every year, whatever company I have found that will insure me that year sends me a cancellation notice before it's time to renew, and sometimes not long before. I have found myself just sweating bullets trying to get an insurance coverage 2 or 3 days before the old one is going to expire. It's never me. It's the, you know, it's the industry that they're turning their backs on. And yes, I've seen it raise and raise and raise and raise to where, you know, I've been asked to pay, you know, $3,500 a year. We have one foster home. We live in it. I'm also asked, do I have anybody with dementia? Because that means I won't get the insurance at the outlandish rates. I won't get it. Do I have anybody diagnosed with Alzheimer's? And many times, I suspected some of my people have had Alzheimer's, but they weren't diagnosed with it. So I go, no, no one's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And you know, that makes me feel crummy. I'm an honest person, and I try to do the right thing and live a moral life. And shading things like that, you know, I'm ashamed of myself. But I don't want my seniors to pay for my sense of morality. We have people that have been with us. One man's been with us 19 years. One lady's been with us for 15 years. We have two that have been with us 11 years. So these are family. These are family members. And I always live with that stress and that fear that if someday I can't get the insurance, or if someday something else happens or some catastrophe down the road, it will be like sending my mom and my grandma and my daddy uncle, you know, out in the street. You know, we've lost funding for people. We have one lady that was losing her funding, and so we said, you know, hey, we'll keep her anyway. And we do. She gets $500 Social Security, and we keep her. And we've never told her, by the way. She'll never know from us that she's not pulling, you know, mm-hmm. she's not paying the full amount. We have seen, we've asked for to be put in the medical health pool that children's foster homes are in. And we've been told that we are so old and broken down that the state can't afford it. Well, 20 years ago when I started, I wasn't so old and broken down. I might have been able to qualify without costing you all a lot. We're old and broken down because we take care of seniors 24 hours a day. And if you've never had a 24-hour day job, you don't understand it. We go without sleep. We are under incredible stress. These people, these fragile, wonderful people, we make the decision. Should we call the doctor? And if it's nothing, the doctor will think we're a nutcase and then it'll be calling, you know, crying wolf the next time. Do we wait and see if they get worse? We have these stressful things on our, you know, in our lives always. One of my seniors, the one that I've had for 11 years, she is a quadriplegic, and three nursing homes, excuse me, in Eugene turned her down because she is so heavy care. She's a blessing. They were idiots. She's a wonderful person. And we've, you know, I mean, emotionally it's been wonderful. She is like my mom. But, you know, that's what we're facing. Where would she go? There wouldn't be another foster home. She'd go in a nursing home and it would kill her. She's bright and funny and wonderful. So we can't get the liability insurance. We can't get the medical insurance. We have the 24-hour. I've just recently been told, just to give you an idea, that I can no longer, after 20 years, lock my bedroom door when I leave the home. Now, I'm not allowed say on who comes into my home because our seniors have the right for, you know, their family regardless. And we can't check them out. They can come in our homes freely, but I can't lock my bedroom door when I leave. And that's my last little bastion of privacy, the last little thing that I cling to. And I can't do it. I mean, I don't have secrets to hide, but I can't lock the door. Yeah. So this is just, it's one more brick in the wall, as Pink Floyd would say.
Now, do you have a card that you can leave with us? We need to get the information.
I will certainly leave my information. I don't even know if I have a
business
card.
Please save a spot for me.
I hope I'm still in business, but thank you.
I would love to be in your home.
You're totally welcome.
Gary Lane, could you come up for just a moment, please, Gary? And you represent a different twist to this whole thing.
Rachel Elliott is a wonderful person. I asked her to come down. I'm Gary Lane. I'm the president of Adult Care Providers of Oregon, and Bill Morissette and I know each other for a while, and thank you for having this hearing. I run a foster home for mental health, and in case you don't know it, that means that we're all Medicaid patients or residents at my home. My main reason for testifying is simple. I've been without liability insurance now for 8 years. I'm not proud of it. That means I'm bare naked. Anytime there's a lawsuit, I'm broke. I get to lose Monopoly game.
The good news is, if there is good news, they have nothing to get from you, so the lawyers will just take a look and they'll pass you by.
Well,
so either you have full insurance or insurance
at all. That used to be true. I got married 6 years ago, okay. And my new wife has a little bit of money.
Oh, I see.
So
the other thing, Gary, you have, I think, I don't know if it's unique, but you have mentally ill patients. So
yeah, there's all psychotic.
Okay, so now imagine running a home with all psychotic, schizophrenic patients. Now, it's hard enough to do it with Alzheimer's, it's hard enough to do it with normal dementia or with just normal people, but
Alzheimer's, psychotic, they each have the things that can stretch your patients.
Yeah, yeah.
So I won't compare that way. The main thing is that my premium 6 years ago were, 7 years ago, we're in the neighborhood of $1,200. Then they leaped to, 8 years ago, leaped to $1,500. 6 years ago, they went to $6,000 and then $8,000 last time I checked. I don't know where they are now. And basically, if you have someone who is mentally ill, they don't want to write a policy. If they can avoid it. I was quoted a premium with mentally ill, though, the last time I checked, 3 years ago, for $8,000. People who have a foster home like Rachel has,
I don't know, in your policy, do they say nobody with mental illness in there?
Yes, that's another thing that they ask
okay.
for. Do you have anybody with mental illness, and then they don't want to...
I have a doctorate in clinical psychology. My concern is this. Rachel said, truthfully, nobody is diagnosed with a mental illness in my home. She signs that, pays her premiums for 8 months, and then even though she has a 19-year perfect record, something happens. Now, if I worked for that insurance company, I would send a psychologist, a psychometric psychologist out, and I would test all five residents. And just looking at the medications, if someone's taking something for anxiety or depression, I'd say, ah, mental illness. You falsely claimed that you was nobody for mental illness. And how many of our residents in a foster home are taking something for anxiety, depression, sleep, or even some little antipsychotic thing to help settle them down? Okay? So then there's no insurance, and they may hand you back your premiums just so that they absolutely have no liability. But the main thing is, I don't think we have coverage, even if you think you do. That's what I'm concerned about. So not only are the mental health foster homes not coverable generally, but I don't think the senior homes are covered, even though policies are being written and premiums are paid. It's a real problem. It's a bigger problem than most of us think. Short and sweet. That's my testimony.
Thank you very much, Gary. I appreciate it. Yes, sir, would you come on? Thank you, Gary.
My name is Joel Gallup. I'm a reporter at the Newport News Times. I have a thought to toss out. Maybe this is not legislatively feasible, but maybe it is. The voters, as one of the doctors here, recently turned down caps on liability insurance. Maybe that was a good idea, maybe it was a bad idea, but maybe they went about it the wrong way. Maybe there should be a legislatively sponsored deal in which the insurance companies would get a cap, because some amounts are probably preposterously high, in return for which there would be a rollback of premiums to some reasonable year, say 2000, and then a cost that increase allowed that would be only allowed CPI for whatever it is for the state of Oregon on a yearly basis. Go back 10 years later, review it, see if it's still fair to all parties. I've heard insurance here. I had no idea it was that bad. I voted against the bill to limit or cap insurance recovery. Maybe I was wrong. On the other hand, maybe there's a better way than just putting the cap on. Maybe there should be return for that cap.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I just point out that Oregon used to have a cap, and the Supreme Court, in their wisdom, said it was unconstitutional, and that's when we started seeing a spike in malpractice insurance rates and liability in general. You top that off with 9/11, which did it nationwide, and the building industry never plays out, so it's become kind of epidemic. We cannot impose a cap, even as a trial, because the Supreme Court said we did not have the authority to do it. That's why we ran the initiative, because that was the only way we could get the authority to impose caps was constitutionally.
Well, maybe another initiative, but one that's balanced and can draw a lot of votes from the center and the left might be the answer.
This was balanced. It favored everybody but trial lawyers. They have a lot of money.
Joel, we need your last name, if you can come up here and do that. Okay. We're going to have to shut down here pretty soon. Are there other individuals who wish to testify? Yes, ma'am. Please come up. And give us your name, please.
My name is Karen Bondley. I work for Oregon Pacific Area Health Education Center and AHAC, that you may have heard the acronym.
The infamous AHAC.
Yeah, the infamous AHAC. I'm the outreach worker for the coast here, and I work from Astoria down to Yahats. And I also serve on Public Health Advisory Committee, and I just wanted to thank you for your support for the school-based health centers. They're really important in this community. We have four of them. We leverage our funds very well. About half of the funding for the school-based health centers comes from Medicaid, another quarter from the state, and a quarter of it comes from the county and local foundations. And they're just very important to us. They provide about 5,000 patient visits a year. So I just wanted to say thank you for your support.
Karen, would you and Scott please come back up here and tell us what you've learned today?
I didn't know there was going to be a test.
Yeah, this is a test.
Is this a test?
No, thank you very much for those of you who came to testify. But I did want to, you know, you run some unfunded mandates here. So, no. We're asking you to do things that you don't have the money to do is what I'm trying to say. And it's very difficult to be in your position and be responsible for programs that are not, that we cannot fund. So do you have a response to some of the things?
Well, Senator Morissette, like you, I mean, this is very moving to me too. You know, it's easy for me to sit in my office in Portland and make decisions conceptually and abstractly, but when you meet and see the faces of the people who are affected by your decisions, it's a very moving experience, and I'm sure more so for you than for me. But this has been very helpful for me.
It's an aging senior.
I'm in the same age group you are, Senator. This has been very helpful.
Maybe there's room for her.
I want her to take care of me, too. This has been very helpful. I was not aware of the liability insurance issue with the adult foster care homes, and I suppose it's the same issue with medical malpractice insurance. I think we need to somehow investigate how rates are set. I don't know how much justification takes place when rates are raised, and I know that we have limited authority over insurance companies that do business outside the state of Oregon, and that's probably the problem. But I know when House Bill 3630 was passed, there was also a requirement for an investigation into rate setting practices, and that very very august group did publish a report, and it is an informative report, but I don't believe it made any recommendations, or one of the main conclusions that it reached was that we have no regulatory authority in Oregon over the insurance companies and their rate setting. So I think it would help us greatly if we knew more about how those rates were set. Obviously, these people who have no experience, no claims experience, and who are being priced out of the market, there's just something basically wrong there. So that would be my greatest observation. I was very touched by that.
And Scott, as a potential leader of this great organization that you are now in,
Well, Senator Morissette, if you could bear with just one more comment, I would just add that it's been a very fascinating day, and I was very glad to hear some of the issues that were brought up today, because I think that it's something that, funded or not, the Office of Rural Health and the Center for Rural Health needs to look at more closely care for the elderly and the disabled in rural communities. It's a personal interest of mine, and
good.
So it's been particularly interesting.
Well, and I really appreciate you being here because, again, you know, you administer and run some of the programs that we're cutting funding for, which is sad because these are programs that you are responsible for in a sense, and it's also great that you're here to, as we are, to listen to some of the concerns. And that's what really impressed us with going to rural Oregon before, is to meet with people on their home turf and to listen to their problems, people that may never come to Salem for a variety of reasons. So,
thank you, Senator.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting when you talk rural and urban, you know, let me just shift the schools for a minute, and when you hear Portland schools talking about cutting things and programs that we cut 10 years ago. You know, there's a huge, huge difference. You know, Representative Brown knows exactly what I'm talking about. And but I would say, I'm going to defend the insurance industry a little bit because of the fact that, you know, currently in Douglas County, which is where I'm from, there are two docs delivering babies. Okay, we're seeing that more and more. But you know what happened in Douglas County 4 years ago? There was a $10 million settlement for something that wasn't the doctor's fault. Okay?
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
You know, I mean, so you get two or three of those and they shift everything. And I mean, it doesn't take very many. And we have become such a litigious society that we sue over anything and get settlements. And there's a mindset here that is finally coming home to roost, and it's coming home to roost in the reality that you know, who can afford to insure somebody when that's a situation that's out there? I mean, you know, that's part of the reality, we can't ignore that either.
Well, Senator Cruz, I wasn't indicting the insurance industry. I just don't understand how rates are set, and I'm saying it might help us if we had more information.
Well, and we're looking at it. We need to look at, I mean, you know, it depends on who you talk to, but the information I have seen as far as the difference between states with caps and states without caps, it's fairly significant. Now,
you're right.
Other people will tell you that's not true, but you know, at least in the volatility, California has caps. Now, their malpractice is as high as ours, but it's stable. And of course, they deal with a bigger client base, and their bottom line's bigger, too. So, I mean, it's not cut and dried, clearly, but at some point we need to get the people of Oregon to understand the choices they're making. And the choice they made this last time was lawyers over doctors, I think. So.
Well, and what the Senator, what the doctor said about if that malpractice subsidy comes to an end, that will be a devastating experience.
It would be
experience.
Huge. And we did that specifically for rural Oregon, and it took us a while to craft it to where it was specifically for rural Oregon, because clearly we couldn't afford to insure. We couldn't do that for all the docs everywhere. But
Alan, Reverend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't serve on any Health and Human Service committees over there, so I really appreciate the opportunity to sit in on this and hear the. And a lot of my experiences with foster senior citizen foster homes or with assisted living come from a personal nature. That I have a brother that's been handicapped and in and out of care facilities for over 30 years, so, and is now in a care facility down in Roseburg. And so I get some real close personal experiences what's going on there. I sat on a business, labor, and consumer affairs committee, and it's ironic that I've had a number of the people from the building contracting industry come in to talk to me about where their insurance is going, and they're experiencing 400 or 500% increases in the premiums on their insurance. And so there's something more going on out there other than, and I think it's probably more in the legal area as opposed to each of our individual areas there, then we need to look for some sort of redress to some of these insurance premium problems. I certainly thank all of you that have come today to testify here. Really, I didn't realize that there was the insurance problem out there that there is in these homes, and it's something that very definitely needs to be addressed.
Okay, before the gavel falls, Gary, you have one last word.
You
just said it.
Yeah, no. I was still thinking that.
Gary, you've got to come up here and
talk. Oh, okay.
All right. And that's it. We're going to get out of here. Staff has to get home.
Why?
Because they have
going over.
They have a wife or something.
They have a wife.
Chairman Morissette, I was just thinking, Oregon's kind of in a quandary here. Because on one hand, we're encouraging gambling with a lottery and everything, and then the other, we're saying, don't try to get rich by going to the court and suing our butts and getting rich with a lawsuit. you know, by going after doctors and foster homes.
It's not gambling. That's a sure thing.
I know. It's a better shot than going for the lottery. And that's my point.
That's your point. Now, I'm sorry. I overlooked Martha. Marlita, are you here?
Marlita's left.
Marlita
left.
Okay, Marlita. Cleo. Is Cleo here? Bernadette. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, we will close the meeting.